From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The public broadcasting service is much more comfortable airing the news than making it, but a number of issues, both cultural and commercial, have PBS back in the headlines. Costly programming and cable competition are causing commercial creep, and the perpetual hunger for funding has public television hat in hand, swimming against the tide in Washington's conservative climate. Critics on the right are calling for a withdrawal of taxpayer support. Complaints from the other side accuse PBS of buckling to right-wing pressure. Tonight on Point, money, politics, and the future of public television. Do you like the direction that public television is heading? With history channels, nature channels, children's channels, and 24-hour news channels, is public television still necessary to you? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And with me now from Montclair, New Jersey, is Eric Bollert, senior writer for Salon.com. He wrote a piece in Salon this month headlined Paralyzed Broadcasting System. And Eric, welcome. And in the interest of full disclosure, I have to tell you and everyone else that I have spent much of my career working with public television, including creating and hosting the Body and Soul series for PBS. So this is not an unfamiliar topic and not some unfamiliar challenges. But welcome, and let's get into some of those challenges. Let me ask you first to make the case for the difficulties facing PBS right now, and specifically if you could just hold your fire on some of the specifics. In a moment we can get into those. What's the big picture here?
Well, the big picture is the political climate in Washington. I mean, 10 years ago, PBS came under fire when Newt Gingrich came in with the Republican Revolution, wanted to almost cut off funding for PBS, thought it was an elitist organization. That was a failure. A lot of people, a lot of Republicans, actually rallied to PBS's to their behalf, and they were able to sort of ride out that storm. But that put them on notice, and now 10 years later, we're seeing some of the same elements at work, but now Republicans control the House, they control the Senate, they control the White House. PBS doesn't have as many allies in Washington, and after being on notice for 10 years, one of the concerns people in the PBS community feel that decisions are being made about content with too much emphasis on how is this going to affect us on Capitol Hill. What are the lobbyists going to say? Is this going to create a firestorm for our funding? Are we going to get called up for Senate or House committee hearings? So it's not a great environment for PBS in Washington, and I think a lot of people are nervous about stepping on toes or starting a controversy. So before they even start one, they'll sort of back down, and that's the fear among lots of people within PBS is every time they back down, they sort of give their political allies more and more leverage.
So not so much an issue of survival per se, but getting more and more diluted, of the mission becoming more and more blurred?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, PBS has to depend about 20% of its funding from Capitol Hill, which is crucial. And so in terms of what the big picture for PBS is, you know, there's a fear that they're always wondering, you know, what do congressmen think, what do lobbyists think. I mean, you know, a lot of people didn't think it was a coincidence that within the last 6 or 9 months, Bill Moyers left the PBS family, while Tucker Carlson and Paul Gigot, one of the, a conservative for CNN, a conservative for the Wall Street Journal, joined the PBS family. I mean, to a lot of people, that pretty much summed up what was going on, this sort of over-anxious desire to, quote-unquote, balance PBS on the political spectrum, and to make sure that everyone, all the bases are covered, and if they come under attack from Congress, they can say, well, look, we know we just gave Tucker Carlson his own show. You know, 5 or 10 or 20 years ago, there probably wasn't much discussion about, you know, let's dole out X number of slots for conservatives and liberals, and let's cover our bases. I mean, that's being oversimplistic, and people in PBS would probably say we still don't do that. But certainly the notion is that, you know, The big picture has been there's a lot more attention in terms of making sure that firestorms are not created on Capitol Hill, and that not to give the other side too much ammunition to make the charge that it's, you know, it's liberal bias, and therefore give the other side momentum to cut funding and things like that.
And sometimes those firestorms can seem to come from pretty unlikely sources. Tell us the story of Buster, the cartoon bunny rabbit.
Well, as any parent of a young child who watches PBS knows, Arthur is one of the most popular PBS children's television series. And this was a spinoff. It's called Buster, Postcards from Buster. Buster is sort of his over-anxious buddy who travels around the country. The show is part animation, part live video. So Buster goes to visit the rodeo. He goes to visit Mormons. He goes to visit Indians. He goes to visit different places around the country, not so much alternative lifestyle, but local traditions, local cultures, and he brings his camera with him, and he sends back real video of real families, and he learns about the local customs and things. So there's 40 episodes in the series. Part of the funding came from the Department of Education from what's called a Learning to Read grant, and in one of those 40 episodes, Buster went off to Vermont to learn about maple syrup, to learn about living on a farm, to learn about the great outdoors. The first family he goes to visit with a couple of his friends, the family has two moms, and they are in the background. There's no discussion about gay marriage or anything like that. He goes to another friend's house. They also have two moms. So that was the context. The issue, there was no discussion about gay marriage, but clearly for anyone paying attention, he visits two families and they both have two moms. The show is produced at WGBH out of Boston. They work relatively closely with the Department of Education. They gave the Department of Education sort of a heads up that this issue was going to come up. Department of Education asked to see a copy. GBH sent over a rough cut, I think in January. From what I understand, PBS and GBH didn't hear much back. But again, people understood that this is a controversial issue, and everyone wanted to be, on the same page, so it didn't come as a surprise. What then happened was the head of PBS, Pat Mitchell, announced that she was going to take a look at it. She watched the episode, felt it was appropriate, felt it was handled well. But she was going to push the air date back. PBS decided to push the air date back for its 300-plus affiliates to March, just so they could all see it. They could all decide if that's what they wanted to do with their children's programming, if it fit within the local standards and local culture, however you want to describe it. Basically, give everyone the heads up. Here it is. Take a look at it. If you have problems with it, you don't have to air it. That was on a Friday. By the next Tuesday, PBS decided, actually, we're not going to distribute that show. We've changed our mind. It's very rare for PBS to withhold distributing a single program within a larger episode. As I mentioned, Buster has 40 episodes. They decided they were not going to send out that one.
And where on that timeline, Eric, did the new Secretary of Education,
right,
Margaret Spelling, step in?
That day, that Tuesday. There's some conflict over the chronology of that day, but PBS claims it made that decision on a Tuesday and then hours later received a letter from the new Secretary of Education, Margaret Spellings, who actually hadn't even been sworn in. It was literally her first or second day on the job. She zeroed in on this cartoon episode as literally her first action as a secretary. And they sent over a really scathing letter to PBS saying the episode was inappropriate, that many parents did not want their children exposed to these sorts of things. Department of Education actually asked for the money back part of the grant that went to the making of that single episode. And if you do the math, it came out to about $125,000, that they wanted the money back. In the end, PBS asked GBH to produce an extra episode so they would still have 40 episodes. So that was what happened, and some people within the PBS community were sort of stunned at how quickly it was announced that that show was not going to be sent out, and particularly after some of those people saw the episode. It aired on a handful of stations who contacted GBS directly and said, "We've seen it, we're fine with it. Please send it to us. We're going to air it in our markets." What a lot of people were struck by was just how, from the people who've seen it, how very innocuous the whole topic was. Again, it was more an episode about how do you make maple syrup, riding in, playing around in the hay and things like that. There was no discussion about alternative lifestyles and things. So some people were sort of stunned that PBS would decide to withhold the episode based on what a minor role the issue actually played. That said, some PBS stations around the country saw it and decided they didn't want it. Alabama Public Television passed on it. They said it just didn't fit within, their community standards or what they wanted to do with children's television. So, some people agreed, some people disagreed, but it was two things were unusual: to withhold the episode and for a secretary cabinet position to get involved in children's programming. As someone at PBS told me, they've never heard from the Secretary of Education before, and they've certainly never been contacted about a cartoon in the past.
Well, was there any question, either in your mind or among the people you spoke to, that PBS changed its position on this program because of concerns about losing its funding?
The people at PBS said that's not why. They sort of ironically, the reason they told me is the issue of gay marriage or two-mom families wasn't discussed enough in the episode, and that if the goal was to explore this alternative lifestyle, then to be successful, the episode should have spent a lot more time on that issue and not sort of just mentioned it in passing.
Okay, Eric, let me ask you to hold the thought. We're going to continue after a break. We invite you to join the conversation about the future of PBS by calling us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the challenges, both financial and political, that the public broadcasting service is facing these days. And we ask you, do you want your tax dollars to support public television? Are you still watching? And what do we lose if public TV goes away? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're speaking this hour with Eric Bollert, senior writer for Salon.com. His piece this month headlined, Paralyzed Broadcasting System, highlighted some of the challenges that PBS is facing. And Eric, because I had to sort of cut you off in mid-sentence, I just want to make sure you were able to finish your thought about the Buster Gates story.
I think I did.
Okay. All right. And joining me now from Washington is Wayne Godwin, the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer for the Public Broadcasting Service. Wayne, welcome to you.
Thank you, Gail. It's good to be with you. Hello, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
Wayne, let me put it to you, what you see as the moral of the Buster Gates story and what it tells us about some of the larger challenges that are facing PBS these days.
I think Eric has done a relatively good job of laying out the chronology. I would just simply go back and reemphasize that the feeling we had after viewing the tape numbers of times was that the subject matter was matter that actually should be left more in the hands of parents to discuss with their children at an appropriate time, that what had been treated as background came too much into the foreground and was not explained to the degree that we felt the young people should receive that explanation, and that this program was probably not the program in which that should occur. The decision was made, and we stand by it, but the fact of the matter is the Buster series is a wonderful series. It is produced by WGBH, who does great work for us, and there are numbers of episodes in it we take tremendous pride in, as we do with Arthur, so We're moving forward and looking forward to continuing to benefit from their good work and the wonderful people they have over there. Well, as far as the challenges facing public television, if I may, Eric lays it out pretty well. I mean, the bottom line is that this is a difficult period for all broadcasting, but certainly for public broadcasting as well. I will tell you, though, if I may, going back to 1995 and Speaker Gingrich's move to eliminate federal funding, that was turned back. It was turned back to a great extent because, as Eric said, good friends we have in Washington, good friends we have in both sides of Congress, the House and the Senate. But it was mostly turned back because we rely on the individual sitting at home. the public, and the public still believes in public broadcasting. A recent Roper poll said that we're still held number one in public trust. The fact is that over 50% of the people asking that poll, if they thought the tax dollars were for public television were good expenditures and at the right level, and they felt that we weren't receiving as much money as we should. So our sense is where we have always been, which is in the hearts and the minds of the American individual public, is where we need to remain, and that's where our strength is, through our stations and through the programs we provide.
Well, in terms of those programs and in terms of that place, Wayne, is PBS having an identity crisis? Because now there are, as you're certainly aware, so many more outlets for the kinds of programs that used to be exclusively the domain of public television.
I think your point is well taken, in that there are a number of outlets for various genres. But I will tell you that choice, you know, to have that many choices is not necessarily good unless the choices are good choices. Public television remains by far the best choice. Looking out across literally the next year ahead of us, we have a wonderful series running from American I mean, just look right now. If the listener were to turn to television, which we're asking them not to do, and they would look across the dial, they would see Fear Factor. They would see Extreme Makeover. They would see all of the commercial fare that they're accustomed to seeing, and then they would see Antiques Roadshow followed tonight by an American Experience on Malcolm X. That's public broadcasting, and I would take that American Experience and put it against any channel, anywhere, anytime, and it will be the far superior work. It's not just the choice that's there. It's the quality of the choice, and I think public television is going to remain a top-quality product in a world that indeed has numbers of choices, but the quality still is relatively limited.
Well, as you say, the mission of PBS has always been to serve the underserved, and quality certainly has been a hallmark of PBS programming for years. But truly, there are now channels for children's programming and Latino programming and African-American television. So isn't it harder to make the case these days for how PBS is able to do those programs better?
I think the case is made in the programs themselves. I mean, the reality is, and I'll use a tried but true here, there had been hundreds of documentaries made about the Civil War. There was nothing new about covering it in documentary until Ken Burns did the Civil War. And you can take that with jazz, you can take that with our American Experience, you can take it with a number of our other programs, and I think you'll find that there are science programs made every day. But when Nova offers The Wave That Shook the World coming up in March about the tsunami, people will watch it, not just expecting a film about science, but knowing that the quality, the thoughtfulness, the thoroughness is going to be there. And I do believe that's a landmark of a public television program. And even in a world of multiple choices, the quality of those choices is what's going to matter in the long term. And public television is still going to stand out in that area.
Well, Wayne, we have Mike on the line from Apex, North Carolina, who has a question for you. Hi, Mike. Welcome, and go ahead.
Well, it's somewhat of a question and a comment. As a matter of fact, I got off of a telephone call this morning with one of our state legislators, and one of the things that I had expressed to him was currently I do have my own company and things, and I pay before sales tax and all the other taxes that I pay as a consumer, basically I'm losing 56% of my income to taxes. Mm-hmm. And of those tax dollars, I'm because the percentage is so high, I'm becoming more and more conscious of the way that money is used. I've always been a big fan of public broadcast corporation, both radio as well as television. Over the past probably 5 to 10 years, I've noticed small idiosyncrasies which have really begun to bother me. I've stopped my funding for the public broadcasting corporation because of small things.
Like what, Matt?
Small issues of accountability. Like, you know, for instance, my tax dollars went to pay for the show that created so much controversy. From a business owner standpoint, when I look at the judgment of the executives that approved that particular show, I mean, be it whether it's right or wrong, and now they have cost Public Broadcasting Corporation some amount of dollars. I'm sure it wasn't free to actually make the show, But are these people being held accountable?
Okay, Mike, I think we got your point. Let's put that to Wayne about the accountability and also about the amount of tax dollars coming from people like Mike.
No, actually, and Mike, first of all, I agree with you in the sense that we have to be tremendously accountable for the dollars that we use that come both from individuals and come by way of taxes. And the situation related to Buster, first of all, will not use those tax dollars for that particular episode that we've agreed with for the Department of Education. But there were dollars expended there, and those are dollars that we do stand accountable for. We're doing a review of our process that led up to that, and we do feel that the entire situation, were it to have become what it became, which is more of a larger spread concern, should have been caught earlier, and we should have had more thoughtful discussions earlier, and hopefully been able to address it earlier so that the dollars used would have been even more appropriately used. So I will stand accountable for that, and in that and the thousands of hours we do bring you, we would want to remind you that it's probably, as far as the industrialized nations, one of the least funded by federal by the government of any of the other countries. You know the numbers probably from Britain, from France, from Germany. There are literally many, many more times government dollars that go into their product than go into the American form of public broadcasting. And in turn, we turn around and use those dollars to gain additional dollars. Probably one-third of the dollars that go on our national program schedule actually have some degree of routing back to a federal dollar, whereas the remaining two-thirds or more literally come from individuals, come from corporations, come from foundations. It is a good buy, and I would love to have the opportunity to make the case to you with dollars and cents in front of you. I know the people in North Carolina, the network there, and it's a good operation, and I know they're tremendously accountable for the dollars they spend on your behalf. And I think if you look across the entirety of the program schedule and the values you find there, the quality you find there, and the fact that the American public's paying, as I recall, it's about a dollar per person per year, something like that, $1.45. That's a good use of those dollars. And again, in the public opinion polls that we've done across several years, the public still feels, larger than 50% feel, that the dollars are not even enough to do the job. And I think if you look at the challenge you have today, as you flip around the television dial, whether it be cable, whether it be broadcast, the fact of the matter is there is a lot that needs to be done to use that medium well for your education, for my education, and that of our children, and that's the business we're about. So I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with me, and I'd love to think that we could continue to earn your trust, and if we've lost it somehow, we could regain it.
Well, Wayne Godwin, thanks so much for being with us tonight, and good luck with the challenges you're facing at PBS.
We look forward to it. We've got a great season ahead and some wonderful supporters. And, Gail, I appreciate the opportunity of being on the program.
Thanks, Wayne. To Southern Pines, North Carolina now, Donna is on the line. Hi, Donna.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. What was your comment?
I have an interesting story. When I was a girl in high school living in Chicago, PBS there ran a play called Steam Bath. It was wonderful. Bill Bixby, Valerie Perrine, it was shocking. There was some frontal nudity, there was a homosexual couple, and there was God as a Puerto Rican caretaker in a steam bath. These people were dead. They didn't know it. Wonderful play, brilliant. Well, I'm living in San Diego, maybe 83, and all of a sudden Steam Bath is going to play PBS after 10 years. So I'm really excited. Then we find out that it's not going to be aired in San Diego. Very conservative area. We had to drive all the way to Los Angeles, find a motel room in Garden Grove just to watch PBS. Now, how does that happen, that they can go and play things and decide where you could have one thing shown, but in another area you cannot have something shown? This is the kind of thing that bothers me. They'll censor something in one area but allow it to be played in another where people are a little bit more open-minded or curious as to what's going on. Do you have any answer to that?
Actually, I want to put that question to Eric, but first, Donna, before we do that, I'm just curious, are you still an avid PBS viewer, or have you found your programming needs also being met elsewhere?
Oh, I really hate to tell you, but I haven't had television for about 10 or 15 years now. I just can't do it anymore. I can't. PBS is wonderful, and I love it, and when I do have the opportunity at a friend's house to watch, but when I'm at work, I'm talking to people, and it's all about Survivor, and You're Fired, and I mean, all this other stuff on television, And you never hear anybody say, oh, I saw this show on PBS last night. It was just awesome. You don't hear it from a lot of people in the populace. You don't hear about PBS. It's a certain group of people, and if they don't hold on to it, they're going to lose it.
All right, Donna, thanks so much for the call. And Eric, I wonder if you'd comment on Donna's question about are we coming to a time where PBS stations will be even more self-censoring in terms of what they choose to show?
Well, I think that's entirely possible. And to answer the larger question, the reason something was not shown in San Diego and it was in Los Angeles, the PBS affiliates act like sort of network affiliates in that they have programming coming in, but they always have the option whether they want to run it or not. And, you know, a good local broadcaster is supposed to take into account community standards and things like that. So as with PBS, as with the commercial networks, you don't want sort of the monolith of just three or four networks sending out their programming and everyone has to carry it. Local broadcasters can always decide. And that's what happened with the Buster controversy. Sacramento aired it, Boston, New York, about a dozen others, because they thought it made sense and they wanted to air it. So the local affiliates always have a certain amount of leeway in terms of what they're going to air on PBS.
I remember being told early on, Eric, that you have to understand PBS is not a network. It is a collection of 349 separate, independent, fiercely independent fiefdoms.
Yeah, it is. And it's a little confusing for folks on the outside to figure out the difference between CBS and PBS and the CPB and where they get their funding and who does the programming and who owns the stations, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it's not as sort of straightforward as, say, NBC and they have their affiliates, et cetera. It is PBS has been through a few different machinations over the last few decades, and you're right, no one controls everything, and these PBS affiliates want to remain independent and want to have the final say in terms of what they air in their market.
I want to bring Peggy Charon into the conversation now. Peggy is the founder of Action for Children's Television, which is the group that was responsible, I think is fair to say, Peggy, for getting some of the quality kids programs on TV now. She's a visiting scholar at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, a member of the Board of Trustees at Boston's WGBH public television station, and was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1995. And Peggy, I take it that you are still a passionate advocate of public television and wonder, though, whether you share some of these concerns about perhaps an identity crisis and the need for public television.
I certainly am a big supporter of public broadcasting. I don't know where my viewing would go if I didn't have for the stations in Boston to look at. We're lucky we have three because we can see New Hampshire, too. I've listened to a number of these arguments, and I feel like I'm in the middle of Alice in Wonderland. You know what I mean by that? The arguments in those croquet games and whatnot were slightly off the mark. They're a little nutsy, to put it mildly. And I think the problem too often with censorship, and this was an episode of censorship that was really quite disturbing.
You're talking about the Buster episode.
Yes, it's quite disturbing that that the response to Buster and even to the swear words on programs about war, the latest one from David Fanning's wonderful program, Frontline.
From Frontline, yes. It's what some are describing now as the War is Heck program because it was so sanitized.
War is Heck, right. The problem is that that most people who talked about this particular episode never saw it.
Now, you did see the Buster episode. What did you think about it?
Well, I called GBH to make sure this was what the fuss was about because it was so benign and delicious and warm and fuzzy. And the children are the center of all those 40 programs and in that series, and not the parents. And I, consider myself reasonably bright, couldn't find anything that would have caused such a brouhaha. When one kid says, I have two mommies, you know, my daughter used to say that when a friend came over with her children. And they weren't lesbians. They were just two mommies happened to be in the house at the same time. The amazing thing is how censorship works with books. People rant about books in libraries that they haven't opened, that they haven't read. And the same thing is really true here. I mean, there was nothing to fuss about in this program. And there were, by the way, 40 stations that ran it. And there probably will be more as the stations can fit it into their schedule.
Peggy Charon, let me ask you to stay with us. Eric Bollert, stay with us as well. We'll be right back after we take a brief break. We're talking about money, politics, and the future of public television this hour. Are you still watching public TV? And do you want your tax dollars to support it? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about money, politics, and the future of public television. What should the public in public TV mean? With history channels, nature channels, children's channels, and 24-hour news channels, is public television still necessary to you? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're speaking this hour with Peggy Charon, founder of Action for Children's Television, also with Eric Bollert, senior writer for Salon.com. And joining me now from Washington is Tim Graham, director of media analysis for the Media Research Center and author of Pattern of Deception, The Media's Role in the Clinton Presidency. Tim, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Let me ask you what your take on this is. How attentive do you think PBS is to the idea that all voices should be heard, liberal, conservative, all the other shades of the spectrum?
It's not. I think the whole fact that Mr. Godwin would have to sit there and say, well, we couldn't seem to find anyone who saw this show in the entire PBS bureaucracy that would find it a little bit upsetting to show this to four-year-olds, shows you that they are out of touch with a lot of the United States of America and that they don't have anybody on staff who has a less liberal perspective. It reminds one of the Pauline Kael line about nobody I know voted for Nixon. And I think that's the problem, is that there is an insularity inside the PBS bureaucracy that just doesn't get it. And I think that unfortunately, we have Republican politicians who, for the most part, are really afraid to take anything on where every time we try to discuss the public broadcasting system, the editorial writers pull out Big Bird and Ernie and Bert instead of discussing the fact that we were supposed to have a system which had fairness and accuracy and balance and all programming of a controversial nature, and we don't get that. We get instead a system which in many occasions favors the liberal point of view on a lot of topics. For example, the Frontline documentary on the choice between George W. Bush and John Kerry. The John Kerry part of the documentary is very favorable to John Kerry. At the same time that documentary was airing, our national media was focusing instead on the prospects of a documentary that was harsh on Kerry running on Sinclair stations. Sinclair stations don't have a fraction of the reach that PBS stations do. But our liberal media in the United States don't seem to think that bias in favor of John Kerry is a news story when it appears on our public broadcasting system that a lot of conservative Republican taxpayers give that money across for our leaders and our ideas to be attacked and for people that we don't agree with, for politicians that we would not vote for, get hailed and they get glorified.
I think that's why. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead,
I think that's why the solution to these kind of questions is adequate funding for public broadcasting. If there was really adequate funding, a lot of these concerns would disappear.
How so?
Because this particular Buster and Frontline problem, I think, is caused by the FCC all of a sudden initiating extraordinary fines for what they don't like. The maximum fine up to now was $32,500 for a swear word, say, or something that turned off the commission.
What does that
and now it's $500,000 per event.
Well, let me change the subject, if I may, because I want to go to Waterford, Pennsylvania. We have Jim on the line who has an interesting point to make about how PBS is seen in the political spectrum. Jim, welcome. What was your point?
Yes, my comment was I just don't understand why you continue to touch things that are obviously politically charged one way or the other. You know, I used to volunteer and I used to contribute to public television and public radio. It's the same organization in our area. And I don't do that anymore just because it continues to play with these politically charged items. And I always find myself on the wrong side, so to speak, in at least in PBS's vision. I'm on the wrong side. And so I no longer participate financially. I still listen to NBR because I like to hear what the other side is about right now, and that's the way I see it. Why continue to touch these hot items when you're using public funds? You know, that you've done a lot of good, but when you touch these hot items, people get mad and they want to take your money away. And, you know, that's where I stand right now. I would like to just see all public funding or all federal funding or local government funding for NPR or PBS just go away and see if you can stand on your own two feet. If you can't do that, then don't touch the political items.
Jim, thanks for the call. And Tim Graham, let me put a similar question to you. Are you saying that public television is necessary or that it shouldn't get tax funding or that if it's going to exist, it has to be very careful to hear from everyone?
It's utterly unnecessary at this point. And I think that this is part of the problem, though. It's really sort of a multiplying problem for conservatives. Because conservatives really don't believe in it, then they don't work in it. And so we get a very one-sided, stilted bureaucracy inside PBS that thinks they can sell Mississippi on two lesbian moms and thinks that's wonderful. They're clueless. They're not getting it.
Well,
gay marriage referendums have lost in every state in the United States where they've been put to a vote, and PBS still thinks they have to force this down the throats of four-year-olds.
Let's give Eric a chance to get in here, Tim. Eric, go ahead.
It's interesting. The DOD, the Department of Education got a copy of the episode, and if they're so out of touch, how come no one there raised objections until Margaret Spellings decided to issue a public letter 3 hours after PBS withdrew the episode? I mean, this notion that PBS is just sort of a bastion of liberal media is sort of comical, unless you want to check the payments Tucker Carlson's taking each month or Paul G. Goh.
Okay.
Buckley.
2.5 hours.
For months, for decades, hosted a show.
That's the token program, and you're still having the token program. And does Tucker Carlson do investigative journalism? Does Paul Gigot get to do investigative journalism? No. They're doing talk shows, okay?
Yeah.
Frontline is doing shows that attack the Pentagon, that attack the Bush administration, that attack George W. Bush in their campaign thing. That's
the preference would just be...
When have they done an investigative journalism program, Mr. Bollard, that really seriously looked into John Kerry or any other Democratic politician?
Well, if you want me to send you the front line that did about two or three separate Whitewater investigations that turned out to be a joke, I'm sure someone would be happy to send them to you. They did them during the 90s. They did them during the 90s, and they were a disgrace.
I'll tell you what, folks. Hold on. Time out. Hold on. We're going to go to our phone lines, and we want to hear from Helene, who's calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Helene?
Oh, after the fight that's just been going on, I feel a little awkward interposing here. But
go ahead.
In terms of the relevance of PBS, I remember back to 9/11. No one I knew had heard of Osama bin Laden, but I had because Frontline had done a program on the most dangerous man in the world. And then after 9/11, I can't remember, it was a couple of years ago, when Frontline also did a program on why the towers fell, I remember Congress requesting copies from Frontline because they wanted to know what Frontline had found out. That's the relevance of PBS.
All right. Could we be more absurd? You're trying to tell me that ABC, CBS, and NBC didn't report on Osama bin Laden.
Tim Graham, did they?
2 years before 9/11?
Yes, because he was suspected in the bombing of American embassies in 1998.
Not to the extent that Frontline did. Not hour-long programs on
terrific.
It.
Well, Tim Graham, let me mention that Newt Gingrich, who spoke to a meeting of PBS station managers in Washington a couple of years ago, said that commercial television was a pretty good argument for why we should have an alternative.
This is the man that tried to get Big Bird off the air when he...
Okay. We seem to have lost one of our connections to Washington. We'll see if we can regroup for a moment here. Peggy, are you still with us?
I think that all this proves is that you need funding for public broadcasting that is outside the political process. You need a big trust fund or an endowment that can come from the money from the sale of the analog channels when we all go digital. And it'll be billions of dollars. Now, you don't have to put every cent of that into public broadcasting, but it's a perfect place to take the money and keep the system from depending on what they say in Washington.
Well, Peggy, would that solve the matter of political pressure, though? Because doesn't Congress have to approve whatever happens to that money?
Well, if it's set up as a trust fund, you would set it up out so that Congress doesn't have the kind of battles that we're having now over the content of two or three or four television programs. That's not healthy in a democracy. It's like moving in on the books in the library.
Well, from your position as a member of the Board of Trustees at WGBH, which is one of the premier public TV stations in this country, provides a lot of the programming for public television, do you see PBS as being particularly embattled now?
Right this minute, I certainly do. yes, I think that it's embattled when money is hard to get. And money is hard to get now. And then it's a question of whose ox gets gored when you move in on a particular part of the funding. It shouldn't be up front in public broadcasting's head. Who's giving the money that's going to complain if they have two mommies in a program, or if they swear a bunch of soldiers while they're fighting use a swear word? I mean, that's a preposterous problem to worry about. And I think the fact that the Secretary of Education in this new administration, and at the second day she's in office, with all the problems of education in this country, enormous problems that we have to deal with, she picks on a half-hour cartoon that, I tell you, was really a deliciously benign program until it started to get all this press.
Peggy, I have to stop you there. Thanks so much for being with us. The founder of Action for Children's Television, Eric Bollert, thank you so much for joining us as well. Senior writer for Salon.com, the recent piece entitled Paralyzing Broadcasting System. Tim Graham, I know you can't hear us, but thanks for being with us. Director of Media Analysis at the Media Research Center, a nonprofit conservative media watchdog. And Wayne Godwin joined us earlier from Alexandria, Virginia. He's Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Public Broadcasting Service. You can continue the conversation online, onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, celebrating President's Day on the Texas-Mexico border. This is On Point. Many President's Day celebrations have been taking place around the U.S. today, but one of the biggest occurred this weekend in Laredo, Texas, where tourists and locals came out for the 108th annual George Washington birthday celebration. Throughout its history, Laredo's party for the Founding Father has included a cross-border bridge ceremony in which U.S. and Mexican children and dignitaries meet in the middle of the bridge to exchange abrazos, or hugs. This Saturday, Laredo's annual Washington extravaganza culminated with a jalapeno eating contest and a parade, which drew tens of thousands onto Laredo's streets. The procession boasted elementary school cheerleaders, Mexican drum and bugle corps, and smiling law enforcement officers. In this radio diary, participants talk about the origins of the tradition and what the parade means to them.
Hi, my name is Linda Lamantilla. I'm from Laredo, Texas. I'm president-elect of the Washington's Birthday Celebration Association. There's numerous families who have ancestors that fought in the Revolution, and somehow or another they managed to make it down to Laredo. And at one point, you know, then they started marrying the Hispanics and intermingling the two customs and the two cultures. And at one point, those that really had strong ties to Washington said, we need to do something so that we cement our American ties, as well as embracing the Mexican culture. And George Washington was that man. He was very popular in Mexico, as a matter of fact. We start off with, at 8 o'clock, we have an international bridge ceremony. It is the only place in the United States where we actually close an international bridge. And what we do with the folks from Mexico gather on one side and the folks from the United States gather on the other side, and we meet in the middle of the bridge. We have a short ceremony. Our speaker today is Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison. And then we start exchanging abrazo. We have two children that represent the United States and two children representing Mexico that are from Nuevo Laredo that are our ambassadors throughout the year, attend several events in their colonial costumes.
My name is Carlos Antonio Alvarez. I'm from Laredo. I'm 9 years old, and I'm going to hug the Mexican people to show the friendship of America. I'm going to walk on the bridge of Mexico and America, and then I'm going to hug the girl Kaylee, and then I'm going to hug the boy Max, and then I'm going to take the Mexican people to walk back where I was.
Bienvenidos y gracias por acompañarnos. This ceremonial abrazo exchange between our children that we see today representing the United States and Mexico also represent our hopes and aspirations for continued relationships and strong values for many years to come.
I'm Lisa Morales. I'm the executive director, and I'm here from Laredo. We do have participants from Mexico, and what we do, we make sure that they all know that all credentials for traveling into the U.S. need to be adhered to, and we put that into our application so they're prepared with visas or passports and that they come prepared to cross into the U.S. So just by, you know, being an entry in the parade doesn't give you automatic access to the U.S.
Lisa Rendon, and I've been here for the longest time. My son and my nephews spend the night here so that we all can have a place to sit. We're about 50 to 60 persons here. We have a big picnic every year. We make it a point to be here. We even came from San Antonio at 2:30 in the morning to be here for this event.
My name is Malia Watson, and I'm a librarian at the Laredo Public Library. And for 5 years now, we've been participating in the parade. I was surprised when I first got here that there would be a month-long celebration of George Washington and Martha Washington. And then when I got further involved in the community, I realized that it was more than just celebrating George Washington or Martha Washington or anything like that. It was really a celebration of the tradition here that merges two cultures.
Sounds from this weekend's 108th George Washington Birthday Celebration in Laredo, Texas. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.